I'm delighted to welcome this morning Anne Phillips, who is from Barclay Legal. Welcome, Anne.
Good morning. Welcome.
So you are a solicitor. How would you describe your field of soliciting, shall we say? What niche are you in, or are you a generalist?
I started out as a generalist. I'm not a practicing solicitor any longer. I qualified and I started in the days when solicitors did everything, you know, on the high street. And so I turned my hand to whatever was needed, as a lot of people did at that time. But going forward, I sort of worked in larger firms and did commercial law and property law. And now I tend to do just the commercial law with them as a legal consultant with small businesses.
So that's interesting. So you describe yourself as a consultant now, more so than a solicitor.
Well, if you don't have all the certifications and pay all the exorbitant fees, you're not allowed to, actually. You're supposed to describe yourself as a non-practicing solicitor, which seems a mouthful. Right. Nobody understands what it means anyway. But I mean, I'm still me and I still do all the same work as I did before. Only these days I can do it how I want to do, instead of, you know, in accordance with all the dictates of the various solicitors firms who tell you how you've got to do your job.
Interesting. So tell us why you came out of the traditional solicitor model and to do what you do. You've kind of just alluded to it, but talk us through how it works for you.
Well, I think probably I found it hard. I work for different firms with different attitudes, but they're not exactly very employee friendly, I always found. I had some time out for my children, then I went back and I worked for a firm in Kent that was very go-getting, and we all had league tables of how many costs we earned, and it was all, you got to charge everything down to the last quarter of an hour, you got to bill it to somebody, and if you'd have spent 2 minutes on the phone, which never seemed very good customer service to me. Actually, in some ways that was fine for me. It wasn't very satisfying as a job, but I mean, in terms of you got rewarded, if you're good at your job and you've got the fees, you're actually quite well rewarded and respected. So, I mean, I found that was okay in that regard, but it wasn't very fulfilling, shall we say. I then made the mistake of going to work for a firm in Norfolk who was something out of Dickens, and where you were judged purely on how long you'd been there. And as I sort of found myself working for some people who, well, you know, you sort of have someone walk in and they say that the person involved had suddenly disappeared, and you got lumbered with speaking to them, and then you say they were wondering when they were going to get their will, and they said, oh, well, and you say, well, when did you give the instructions? And they would say things like, oh, well, about 18 months ago. And that was sort of okay. And I didn't like them at all, really. I also didn't have a horse, which obviously put me down the league as well, because all the other female fee earners had a horse. And then my husband became very ill and I wanted to go part-time. They initially said yes, and then a week before I was supposed to go part-time, they turned around and said, oh, no, you can't, because the clients won't like it. And so I gave my notice in, and that was it, because I had no choice, really. And I just sort of felt, I didn't think they were very human about that, shall we say, really. And after that, I sort of had no inclination to go back to work for one at all. And I must admit, working for myself, doing what I wanted, going back to, in some ways, how it was, the person I worked for with my first proper job, he was someone who just set up on his own. And that was when we all did all bits and pieces. And actually, he was quite a decent chap. And, you know, to be able to provide a service to your clients was something that, you know, I wanted to do. And that's how I got into sort of working for myself. I did initially while I got going, used to run a bed and breakfast where we lived as well to earn a bit of money, which I can say made me realise that bed and breakfast aren't quite the pleasant thing that everybody thinks are wonderful. Well, they're okay if you've got a large house, shall we say, where you can put your guests, you know, in the converted garage or something like that. But if they're tramping through your home, it's you're never quite sure who's going to walk through the door next. But it was an experience. I got it out of my system.
You did that alongside being a solicitor?
I did that after I'd given up being a solicitor, yeah, while I was getting everything, the other things going.
Right, okay. So it just shows how we can change our direction and mould and modify what we do, and skills are transferable in across so many industry sectors. The number of people I talk to say, oh no, I couldn't possibly do that, I'm a such and such a person or this person, and you know, the industry sector, not realizing that they can transcend different industry sectors. But you've mentioned some very interesting things about interesting descriptions on law firms. I've been a managing partner of a variety of different setups over the years, from high street to I've been involved with the public sector. I ran a big department for a local authority. That was a different culture. The high street practice was a different culture, a couple of different high street practices. And then within them, they were different practice, different cultures. The Dickens one, I can identify with that as well, because that's partly of something that I kind of dabbled in. But at the end of the day, it's about people, isn't it? It's whether you're providing the service. So it doesn't matter who you are, where you are in an organisation, if you're not able to give the service to your clients, that must be so frustrating.
Well, yes, because people wouldn't phone you up because they're sort of always constantly worried what it was going to cost, you know. And it's very hard to do a proper job for someone, because I just think the law is so important to people and their lives and for everything, the whole of society to run properly, that if people don't think they can use it and trust it, it's going to cause lots of problems if it's just something with that only people with lots of money can use. You know, it's people get into a mess, they don't get the right advice. I mean, even now, the sort of to go to court is something that is something that only people with lots of money can realistically do. And so you need to take every last step you can to avoid reaching that point. Mm. Most things you can avoid it.
Yeah, absolutely. We don't know what we don't know. What you said about the charging, you were charging in those days with the firm you were with quarter of an hour. Where I was in one of the corporates, I was head of department. We were billing every 6 minutes, which, you know, so if you took some, you know, a call that was 2 or 3 minutes, you'd bill 6 minutes. And to me, that's completely unethical. But also you've got this different society we're living in now, and people expect to know what the cost is from day one, but can't kind of work out the fact that it depends how much time, and it's, you know, your value in time. So how do you deal with that now, Anne? Because as a sole person, I'm presuming you don't do time recording, you don't time yourself, you've kind of got an intuitive feel on how long a piece of work's going to take.
Yeah, I do need to perhaps get better at that. I mean, the thing is that sometimes how it used to be when I started was that it all balances out to some extent, you know, and some people probably you give people prices, some people it's very easy, straightforward, and they've, you know, probably not paid you for a lot of your time, but then others, they go on forever. If they had to pay for all your time, it would, you know, they just wouldn't. I mean, I do feel actually people are generally respectful of time. I don't tend to get people that sort of pester me with lots of, you know, things that don't matter. I find that they're actually very good about that.
Maybe that's because you've trained them and you've built up a relationship over the years now with them, because you tend, I understand you tend to have kind of repeat clients and referrals and so on. So people have got the hang of you. And tell us about the type of work you do, Anne.
Well, lately, I started off doing terms and conditions and documents, because that's something that I suppose in some ways when I started, I offered all sorts of things, but I found that, you know, it really took off when I offered terms and conditions, because people can identify that they should have them. People have got some very strange views about terms and conditions, you know, because we all get used to going online. You have pages and pages and you tick the box and without reading them, which I do, if it's personal, because you can't do anything about it, can you? A large company, they're not going to, you know, if you want the service, you've got to agree. But that's what I started. And then I've sort of found that from that, people, when they get other, we get talking, I can tell them what other paperwork they should have. And then they tend to find out that if they end up in having a row with somebody, they come back to me as well. So obviously I can't do actual court work, but I do deal with people when they're having rows with people to try and get something resolved. Because again, that with solicitors, I find that some of the letters people have had from solicitors are awful, you know, and they've obviously not, they're just designed to, we're going to add someone who had a letter, they're going to be sued for £30,000 and this, that and the other. And they'd obviously not actually given any thought to the instructions that have been given as to whether it was true. And I hasten to add, by the time they finished, we didn't pay them a penny. But, you know, that it seems as though rather than try and negotiate anything to find out what your facts are and where you are, they'd sort of step into this confrontational thing from the very start. And I mean, these people, they've gone to a firm of solicitors in Nottingham and been told it costs them £1,500 to talk to them. And they said to me, oh, we haven't got £1,500.
Goodness, that's rather remarkable in this day and age. I thought lawyers were trying to get a much better, more friendly, approachable thing. And I thought, maybe I'm wrong in this, I thought that most lawyers still offered a, you know, even if it's only a 15-minute, 20-minute chat. But obviously, I'm wrong on that.
Well, I had somebody else up in Lancaster who she wanted to talk about sort of what documents she needed, and they wanted £600 up front to talk to her. And people just don't go then. Because, I mean, the fact is that probably you've got to get them through the door to do things. If people own a small business, they don't have much money. They are, they've got calls on their money from all directions. They need a website, they need sales, they need marketing and all this sort of thing. And the legal things I find get forgotten about. One, because nobody promotes them to them. And two, if they think about it, they think, oh, that's lots of money, I'm not paying that. And there's no sort of, I'm sort of trying to put across the value of and the need to do this. And but to actually, having done that, you also need to provide them with a solution that's affordable, so they can understand, they can take it on board. I mean, I tend to find that once you get people involved and you get them started, they then start to be quite interested about you know, having the right documents in place, when they realize, you know, they can come to me and I will do it for them at a cost that won't cost them an arm and a leg. And then they sort of get the satisfaction knowing that they are protected. But so many people just don't even start down that path, unfortunately.
As you say, you know, we're not trained, we're not taught about all the things that we need to do. When I mean, there's lots of courses now where people are starting a business, but so many people, as you say, haven't got the money. And also they don't seem to realise the value of prevention. It's the same with the insurance industry, the health industry, you know, legal. There's so many different industry sectors. If we were to do all the things that we're supposed to do to start with for prevention, we'd never actually get off the ground running a business in the first place. So sometimes I think, you know, you do have to take a flyer and, you know, go on a wing and a prayer. But in terms of terms and conditions, are there any particular kind of standard things that people can do without consulting somebody like you, or would you recommend that You know, there, I mean, is there like a shopping list of things that people can do themselves versus what they should really take advice from somebody like yourself?
They should write everything down that they agree with somebody. I think that's, you'd be surprised how many people don't do that, as to what they also need to write down. They get the how much it's going to cost and when they're going to get paid. They always seem to get that bit, but they never actually write the exactly what they're going to offer, when they're going to offer it. I think that is one thing that they need to think about, and also about making sure they own the copyright in things. That's actually a more complicated thing than people realise. Because if somebody works for you, you know, say if you just use somebody, engage someone's services, and they do something, piece of work for your client, that person owns the copyright. You don't, and your client doesn't. And I've had people get caught out with that. If this other person then realises what power they've got.
That's interesting. So run that by me again. The person who did the work
owns the copyright. Whoever they are, if they're your employee, you will have an employment contract that will say that, you know, you own the copyright, not the employee. But if they're just sort of a third party that you engage, you know, like how people think how clever they are not to employ people and keep themselves employed. Uh-huh. I had someone who did this, and they had someone doing their accounts like that, and he devised an accounting system. And then he one day said he wanted a bill, wanted £4,000 for her to be able to continue to use it because he owned it. And I had the unpleasant task of telling her that he was right.
Goodness, how interesting. I never would have thought about anything like that. It's do you offer kind of question and answer? I keep on seeing on LinkedIn these days, ask me anything. People are putting up these, like, you know, half hour free things to basically ask any question about whatever their industry sector is. Do you do anything like that, Anne?
I'll ask simple questions. If it sort of gets complicated, they can pay me for an hour of my time. But for quick questions, I'll usually answer them for people, yes. But the thing is, actually, with terms and conditions, I mean, I've just redone my website, and there is a section on there where you can get a basic template for about £200. So that would cover the basics, because there are differences depending on whether your client's a private individual or a business, which a lot of people don't realise. Because if your client's a private individual, you've got to comply with all the consumer laws, and which a lot of businesses seem to think just apply to, you know, your next and your big companies. Then you point out they apply to them. They're quite horrified. And but equally, if it's a business, you can set it out as you want. And equally, people need to look at terms and conditions that they get given. Mm. So many people, I've had several of these, they won't pay to have their own done. They want to do business with someone. They say, oh, well, we'll use theirs. But it never seems to occur to them that they'll be drafted totally in the other person's favour. Then something happens and they sort of say, oh, what can I do? Oh, dear, I've signed this. And you say, well, you shouldn't have signed it in the first place.
Yeah. It's amazing, isn't it? All of this sounds perfectly common sense. But when we're in the heat of arranging something, we have an idea, we just kind of toodle off and we just kind of, well, as I say, just fly by the seat of our pants, really, don't we? A lot of business people do that. And very often it's a case of physician, heal thyself. It's all very well, you know, saying all these things, but Do you have your own terms and conditions? Seeing that it's your specialism, I'm presuming you do have some kind of T&C.
Oh, yes, I do. Yes, I've just rewritten them, actually. I tell people I keep them short and simple, but because I'm aware of all the horrible things that can happen. Mine are actually quite long, but yeah. Oh, yes, I've got mine. I mean, to actually do it properly, you need to sit down with somebody and go through the business. start at the beginning, get them to work out at each stage what they want to happen, then fit it in the terms and conditions. So that's how it's going to be. And I find a lot of people say they find it very useful because it makes them assess their own business as to how they want it to work in a way they've probably never done before.
That's a really good idea, actually. It's almost, so you're almost a business consultant as well as, you know, specialising in the terms and conditions, because you can't do one without knowing that information, can you?
No, you've got to go through it all, really. I think also some solicitors are rather guilty, you know, these days of your, where you've got it all on a computer and you can look at which clauses you want and press the buttons. And some of them are so long-winded, it's unbelievable. And they've obviously clearly done that. Whereas actually, practically every business does need its own, if you're doing it properly, because certain things are the same, but a lot of the people there, it's all very individual what they do and how they want things to work. But it's just getting across to people. I mean, I get a lot of clients, you say about they don't do it to begin with. But then again, the bulk of my clients have come to me are people who've been going a short while and they've hit an awful problem and they've come out of it and decided that they're never going to go through that again. And now they'll get their terms and conditions done when actually if they'd done it to begin with, they wouldn't have been through all that. So it's just a question of trying to sort of get them to consider it a bit. I mean, I understand you probably don't want to do it when you start. You don't know if you're ever going to get any clients, but I think once you've got rolling, you do need to, people need to consider it before they do. I think that's what I would say.
Yeah, absolutely. Great advice. What about this AI that we have now to contend with, the ChatGPT or whatever the thing's called? I'm hearing a lot of people that are, I heard somebody the other day that created a landlord tenant agreement using ChatGPT, and I thought, how accurate would that be? How convincing and useful would it be? What do you think?
I don't know, actually. I've sort of not really got into it a great deal because it's okay if you want to do some posts on social media or something like that where it can be a bit general, but the trouble is that legal stuff needs to be so accurate that you can't afford for some AI just to make the slightest mistake, because it could have so much consequences, really. I think it's got its uses in business generally, but I think for legal stuff, I know some people say, you can use it, but then perhaps all these solicitors pressing the button on their computer program, it's not really going to be much different from that anyway, is it? They're doing already. That's what's me being cynical.
I used it recently for something, and it had a spelling mistake. And I thought, well, that's not very good, is it?
No.
Say it's for some things it's okay, I think, but for legal, I don't think it would be a good thing to use personally. But there we go. These bright young things now in the law firms with their horses and their fancy clothes and all the rest of it, it's a different world that we were brought up with, Anne, isn't it? Totally different.
Well, yeah, I mean I did my articles with a firm in Birmingham, and it was very old-fashioned. You know, they had the long corridor in a rather dingy office, and all the partners had their offices off, you know, and they all sat there burrowing away. And chap I was article two, I don't think he'd be allowed to practice these days. He was what you'd call eccentric. And I can remember wanted everything to be just so. And his longstanding secretary went and retired while I was there, unfortunately. And we had a parade of secretaries who used to rush out crying and leaving. And he said to me, "What's wrong with these girls? And what's wrong with them?" And you think, well, perhaps the fact that you shouted at them might have had something to do with it. But it just shows how, having said that, he was probably the best solicitor I ever worked with, because he was very clever. But people like that, it's just a different life these days, isn't it, the way it's all run?
It is, yeah. Like you said, Dickens versus the modern day, and probably I remember my family, my parents and grandparents, and getting scared. I remember my mum died in 2015, and she was saying how scared she was getting the way the world is going. And I'm in that situation now, you know, looking at my grandchildren, thinking what world are they going to be living in, and their children, and so on and so forth. But it's progress, isn't it? We need to embrace all this stuff, and we can't fight it, just go along and find the best way we can. And I think being more mature, I think, is helpful. So when we both glibly referred to horses in so on, but it's I love horses. I've got a horse, a pig, and a horse, a pot-bellied pig, and a donkey that live up in the land opposite where I live here in the Algarve, and they're beautiful creatures. But the culture, that's kind of what you were alluding to, isn't it? The type of set, you know, that people people live in their own bubble. So lawyers and accountants as well, have had experience in, you know, working and leading those organizations, tend to have a kind of an air about them that you have to be kind of an elite type of lifestyle, and, you know, above everybody else. How do you think that is in today's world, that kind of take on?
I've had lots of people complain to me about accountants and say that they, you know, if they have small business, they're made to feel that they're not important. So I get asked a lot of things about the, you know, accountancy stuff as well. Because when I did the bed and breakfast, I did a load of bookkeeping as well for myself, and got other people asked me to do theirs. So I got quite into all that as well as the legal stuff. I think people have got that attitude. One thing that has changed is that when I was training, you got a grant to do your degree, and you got a grant to do your Law Society exams. And everybody who went through got articles. I mean, some people used to say, you know, joke about you've written the 100th letter and before they got in, but everybody got in eventually. Whereas now you've got to have how many thousands of pounds to do your Law Society exams, haven't you? Whatever they're called now. And it's very hard to get articles. And I think it's putting, I mean, I came across someone at the university in Lancaster who she said she gave up, and she got a perfectly good degree, and she'd gone to become a legal executive because she couldn't afford to train as a solicitor. And so I feel that it is only people with money and contacts who can actually become solicitors, whereas when I did it, if you have the brains, you could do it.
Yeah, that's a good point, isn't it? The money side of things now, and even ordinary degrees, the kids come out with debt, which I think is just not a nice way to start, you know, working at all. Doesn't matter what industry sector you're in. But when I did my MBA legal practice at Lottingham Law School, I graduated in 1997. So I did my thesis on the use of paralegals. And at that time, paralegals were hardly ever heard of. And it's similar to what you were saying about that young lass in Lancaster who couldn't get articles. So she, or whatever they're called these days, training contract, isn't it, they call them, becoming a legal exec. It's been going on forever and ever. So I'm going back, I don't know how many, well, over 20 years, isn't it? 26 years since I graduated. So that was, and I didn't graduate as a solicitor. Mine was in management. So that's where I've, you know, had the chief exec roles rather than actually doing the thing. But the cost of studying anything these days, you have to weigh up, is it worth it? And what's the right approach for you as an individual? And the way you've gone through your career with the diversion into bookkeeping and hotelier and so on and so forth is interesting. So thank you for sharing some of that with us today, Anne, and your expertise. So how can people get hold of you if they want to have a conversation about terms and conditions for their organisation?
Well, they can look at my website. That is Barclay with a K, legal.co.uk, or they can, I'm or email us, anne@barclaylegal.co.uk.
For those listening on podcast, can you spell Barclay, please?
It's B-A-R-K-L-E-Y.
Marvellous.
Not a bank.
Not a bank, indeed. Okay, thank you so much for your time today, Anne, and long may you continue enjoying what you do and not worrying about the legal side of things, not legal side, the payment side of things with all these licences and all the rest of it. But you're still doing a sterling job. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.